We're so lucky that we enjoy here in Wisconsin a really rich diversity of wildlife, and it brings me anyway, I bet it does you too, a lot of enjoyment to notice and appreciate what's going on around us in different seasons. And we are really fortunate to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven come by once a month to share what he's been seeing and to help us understand what's going on out there. Scott, great to have you back.
Well, it's good to be here, even though we're a little closer to Christmas than normal. That's okay. We'll come up with some gift ideas a little later.
But. Yeah, we should do that. What are you seeing out there for any interesting wildlife observations?
Well, I'm hearing it seems like my feeding stations have been very active this year, and I'm not altogether sure why, unless it's carryover from the drought that the seed crops are down or something. But yeah. And I've got an unusual number of woodpeckers. I can hardly keep the suet cakes in the suet feeder.
Oh, you're kidding.
And it's just a steady stream of downies, hairies, red bellies. That's really been nice. I like to see the woodpeckers. And I'm hearing that feeders from... From Lake Superior all the way to Illinois line, I've had lots of winter finches already. The grosbeaks and the crossbills and the siskins and the red poles and all that stuff. And that's good news, too. I've not seen any of those personally, but maybe some of our listeners are having a good feeding season.
Yeah, and, probably hear from them.
Can give us a call. So,
well, I tell you what, every phone line, before I even give the number, is full. So I'll give the number. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can join in with that phone number after we deal with a caller or two. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or certainly post a photo or a question or comment on my Facebook page, which I haven't gotten up yet, but I'll do that as we move along here today. First, though, let's go to the phones.
Let's do it.
Mary in Madison, thank you for calling.
Hello. Yes, I came across in the Arboretum Madison newsletter a reference to a mammal study on their outlying properties mm-hmm. in Wisconsin, and I think it was a southern bog lemming, mm-hmm. and I never heard of such a mammal in Wisconsin. Could you... give some information about its life cycle?
Sure. Do you recall where they came up with that specimen? It's a northern species, but the Arboretum has properties and an interest in properties all over the state. Do you recall offhand?
I can't remember the property, but I know they have properties in northern Wisconsin
right.
as well as southern.
And that's where we'd expect to see it. If you're looking for it, its scientific name is Synaptomys cooperi, the southern bog lemming or lemming vole. It's a member of the vole family, and we've got a bunch of voles. And down here, the meadow vole and a couple others are very, very common. As you get further north, the red-backed vole, and in some cases, the bog lemming are a bit more common. Bog lemming's not terribly common anywhere. And as you expect from its name, it's usually found in lowland areas in the northern part of the state. A stubby-tailed, blunt-faced, fuzzy little guy that looks like a fuzzier, smaller version of the very common meadow vole that people are grappling with. In fact, I think we have a call coming up about voles. Major winter problem around here because they're active all year beneath the snow. So anyway, that's a bit of a description and range, and not something you're likely to see down here, but an interesting little small mammal. In fact, all of our small mammals are kind of interesting, and we've tried to make that case over the years that these little guys are out there, they're readily available for people to see and observe, and you know they're out there trying to do everything that the big stuff like the bears and the deer are doing. They're just doing it on a smaller scale.
Thanks, Mary, for calling. Appreciate it. Somebody's posted a nice photo on our Facebook page over there, Scott. There we go. And I'm not sure who it's from. Some pine siskins, right?
Yep, that's right. And that's exactly right. And it looks like is that a bath or a feeder bowl? I can't tell. It looks like a dog dish, actually. Well, anyway, they seem to be having a good time. That's a very nice photo. So
yeah.
It's pretty cool that technology's allowed us to see all this stuff. I mean, I remember in days gone by, you remember the famous it's a prairie dog, no, it's a woodchuck issue, and we had to wait days to get a Polaroid snapshot in the mail, and now the stuff is here instantaneously. It's pretty cool.
Another nice shot.
Yep.
Really great shot. So go to my Facebook page if you want to see these photos. You don't have to be on Facebook or a member of Facebook to look. So if you're not, you can still go and look. Bob in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just got a couple observations and a question from a few years back. It involves an area that I go to in Forest County quite a bit in northern Wisconsin. I've seen a lot more fishers. Any comment on that? A lot more. I used to see them occasionally, but now it seems like a lot.
Well, I mean, fishers have expanded their range. They've done very well. A fisher, for listeners not familiar with them, is a big member of the weasel family, a mustelid, and they were reintroduced to Wisconsin back 50, 60 years ago, and they've done very, very well.
Yeah, cool
originally,
to see.
Originally, they're a cool animal, and they're fairly easy to identify, so there's not much mistaken identity problem with fishers. They're kind of a northern third of the state animal, but they've been creeping further south in recent years, down into the southwestern part of the state, and even some counties not too far here from Madison. But overall, the population is perhaps still expanding, but I think overall numbers, I think the thinking is that the numbers have started to at least level off, if not maybe decline a little bit after that early explosion for a few decades. However, that doesn't mean there aren't still areas where they've either just moved in or they're doing exceptionally well. No animals are evenly distributed across the landscape, so no matter what species we're talking about, there are going to be areas where it seems like they're thicker than hairs on a dog, and there'll be other areas where, hey, I haven't seen one for a long time. That's just the way it is.
Yep.
And my second part of my question, in the same area, and nobody believes me to this day, probably, I want to say 6 years ago, I had a wolverine encounter, and nobody believes me. I know what they look like. I can't document with a camera nor tracks, but any other reports ever recently in Wisconsin?
No, none that have borne out, not for many, many, many years. And we learned a long time on the program to never say never. There's always a weird possibility, but I don't believe there are any wild individuals in this state. I think over my 30-some years on the job, I can remember at least two and I think three incidents where dead wolverines were recovered, roadkill, and then there was a famous picture of one loping across. I think it was one of the lakes up near Horican Marsh. Ice fishermen took the picture. And in those two and possibly three cases, those things were investigated by the conservation officers, and the animals were traced to captive animals, game farms, that kind of thing, and were escapes. So, hey, it's always possible that one got away. It's not a common animal in captivity, but wild individual, we're a long way from a long way from wild populations, and there's been no attempt to restore them, and there's really no dialogue on that either. So I'm reluctant to say I kind of joined the group of doubting Thomases, but you seem to know what you're looking at, and again, stranger things have been seen.
Yes.
It was in northern Forest County.
Yeah.
Mega, mega rural. It's just something that I'll never forget, and it was an encounter I'll never forget, and
You seem pretty certain, and it's a good memory to have.
Yep. Good luck. Thanks a lot, Bob, for calling. Appreciate it. And more photos on our Facebook page. Terry sent us a photo of a pileated woodpecker, which is a cool shot, and also of a chickadee coming up to the feeder. So that's kind of cool as well. Thanks for sending those along, Terry. Appreciate it. We have Brooke in Eau Claire with a question next for you. Let's go to her. Hi, Brooke.
Hi. Yes, I'd like to know. I thought wolves were so incredibly elusive. How did they manage to kill so many so quick? And then are there any fishers in eastern Pepin County? And I'll hang up.
Okay,
so first question, Brooke, as far as the wolves are concerned, we might as well give the update right now and put that behind us. As of last Friday, the 7th, 104 wolves have been registered. I know there have been at least a few more since then because Zone 5 was just closed actually today, and Zone 6, I think, is expected to be closed perhaps as early as this Friday. there are perhaps just several wolves left on the quota, and the season is going to be over and done with. So despite the fact that it was originally scheduled to go until, I think, the middle of February, perhaps February 15th, it certainly didn't go that far. So the basis of your first question, how in the heck did that happen, is the $64,000 question.
Yeah.
All the folks I talked to in the world of wolves, and including myself, thought that when dogs were taken out of the mix, that was going to be the most effective tool for harvesting these animals. And even with no dogs, and that's another story we can come back if someone calls about it later, even without dogs, the trappers and hunters have managed to meet the quota here way ahead of schedule. Now, I think what's happened, I think there'll be all sorts of speculation. First, that, oh, geez, we're way more wolves than everybody said. I'm not sure that's the case. Mm-hmm. I think the preponderance of the animals taken have been younger animals,
young
animals that are less experienced and apparently were more vulnerable to trapping and hunting than we may have thought. Either that or the folks who actually got the tags in their hands were darn good at what they do, even with no track record here in Wisconsin. Either way, I think the last time I checked, it was running about 2-1 trapped animals versus shot animals. That might have ratcheted up a little bit in favor of shot animals during the gun deer season. But either way, the quota's on the verge of being reached, and I think there were no incidents that I'm aware of in terms of flagrant violations or safety issues or anything else. So I think we'd have to say that things went according to plan, and it's likely the DNR gleaned a lot of useful information from this inaugural hunt. And assuming it continues, they'll be able to fine-tune the permit allocation and distribution and a variety of other things, and we'll see where it takes us in the future.
And the other question related to fishers in eastern Pepin County.
Oh, yes. To be honest with you, Brooke, I would not rule out the possibility of a fisher sighting in virtually any county and any area in the state, with the possible exception of pretty unlikely in the agricultural, industrial, urbanized southeastern corner, but everywhere else, no problem.
We had a Facebook question from Marge. Is the hunting in state parks a final decision? If so, what's being hunted in April? And how should birdwatchers prepare to be safe?
Well, good question, and I assume this has been just a red-hot topic for the last few weeks. And I think it finally reached resolution last night, at least I think resolution, because what the DNR board voted on, I think they were essentially given the latitude to shape the final proposal. So if I understand correctly what the negotiations led to last night, and lots of people traveled from all over the state to come voice their concerns, which were running
way,
you know, 95 out of 100 against probably the whole proposal. But
including hunters.
Right, including some hunters. That's true. And it really seemed like a long time period. The reality was that there were only a couple of sub-periods within that long time frame, which essentially I think was from mid-September into April or the end of April. There were really only a few time periods in there, primarily gun deer season and probably turkey hunting, where there would have been any substantial interest or participation from the hunting community. So I think that the notion that parks would be inaccessible or dangerous for that extended period were maybe a little bit overblown. But nevertheless, the balance or the deal struck apparently will allow the parks and trails to be open during the window, I believe it's from November 15th to December 15th, which encompasses the bulk of the firearms deer hunting, a one-month period, and then another period in April, and the question, why April? That's turkey season. So basically it's come down to a four-week window in late fall and a several-week window in April to allow turkey hunting. Now, as far as the issues there, the deer hunters, especially gun deer hunters in Blaze Orange, are pretty conspicuous, and, you know, that's, well, we'll see how it all plays out. But that's a period in the year where the weather can be getting kind of sloppy, and I think hiking and a lot of other activities may have wound down. It's a little early for some of the cross-country skiing and so forth. So I'm hoping that conflicts will be minimized in April, when the turkey hunters are out, they're in full camouflage. They're very quiet. There are a limited number of permits issued. And frankly, I'd be surprised if many parks users, other than seeing a car in the parking lot, would even be aware of a turkey hunter present, unless they literally stumbled across them. So, and that's a shotgun issue. Turkeys need to be at close range to be a potential target. I think in terms of being safe in the spring, you know, bright colors and make a little noise, the kind of the way you'd behave if you were in bear country, I don't think there's really any issue there. The gun season, if your favorite park or whatever is being heavily utilized, you know, for a couple of weeks, just stand down. And so I think a reasonable compromise was reached on what was a very, very contentious issue.
Jim in Wausau, we're going to get to you in just a minute, but just a reminder, we're visiting about the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network as we talk wildlife with Scott Craven. Larry Mueller here, and the number to call for you to join in, 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page. You can post a photo or a question or comment there at the Larry Mueller Show. I'd love to hear from you. And let's turn to Jim in Wausau, who's been waiting a bit here. Jim, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Good morning. This is a bull mystery. I keep an empty ice cream bucket under the outside water faucet for my garden.
Mm-hmm.
And this November, when I turned off the water, I went to take the bucket away, and it had a couple inches of rain in it from recent rains. And I found two dead voles in it.
Mm-hmm.
And in a couple decades of gardening, I've never had this, and I'm just wondering, why two? Did one actually squeak to the other for help or something?
I think that was a random event, you know, given how dry it was this year. In most cases, all animals were scrambling for water. I ended up actually having to cut a couple of 5-quart ice cream pails just so they were only about an inch deep, and I started putting those around on the deck and even out in the garden with a little water in them because there was just nothing around. So anything that had water in it was likely attractive, and anything that has a high side is essentially a death trap for small mammals. In fact, there are some bizarre trapping techniques that actually use pails or buckets of water as a capture technique. That's another long story. But nevertheless, if the voles scrambled up there or hopped up on the edge or however they got up there trying to get some water and fell in, they were goners. The fact that there were two, no relationship to social behavior, but they're incredibly abundant animals. It could have just as easily been 20 if the water was very attractive. So
no.
I think the fact that it was two has no particular significance. The fact that they drown in the water is not that uncommon either when water's out like that and mammals actually can get at it.
Oh, there we go. Thanks, Jim. Kim and Ladysmith, hi.
Hi. My friends call me the bird nerd because I write down a lot of things on the calendar.
Well, you're the one we need to hear from then.
Yeah. I noticed that I had common redpolls already. I saw one male, just a beautiful male. That was on Monday. And then yesterday I saw a few more, and I see the pine siskins with them too.
Mm-hmm.
And I just write down a lot of things. I've had a pileated on my maple in the front yard, and I don't know if that whole part is going to fall because it's, you know, really huge holes. I live by the Flambeau River, so I can get a lot of birds. So I just wanted to ask if you think the common redpolls came in a little early this year.
Oh, they definitely came in early, and we've also, have you seen any of the grosbeaks yet? Any grosbeaks?
Just my cardinals.
Okay. Well, there have been quite a few reports of evening grosbeaks quite a ways south, almost to the southern part of the state, and some pine grosbeaks, which are more unusual, and even folks now reporting white-winged and red crossbills as well. So keep an eye out. There's lots of neat stuff around this year.
I have not seen an evening grosbeak since I was little. They just are not around here.
Well,
maybe they will fly in.
They come and go. They travel in wandering flocks, and if you do get any grosbeaks, you usually get a bunch of them at one time, and holy cow, the name grosbeak is a very good description of the bird. They have a really big beak, and if you get a flock, you better run to the store for more sunflower seeds because they can really go through them.
I go through it already, yeah.
All right, thanks a lot, Kemp, for calling. Appreciate your call. Here's a cute comment from Kat. We have a bird living in a light fixture on our back porch. We have a compact fluorescent bulb in the fixture. It must be warm enough to be inviting to the bird.
Well, in this case, the birds know best, so their choice of roost sites, nest sites, and a variety of other things is often somewhat baffling to us, but this bird seems to have figured it out.
Fred,
whatever it is.
Whatever it is,
whatever
yeah.
it is.
Fred in Cascade, hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to say a couple of things. I heard a call earlier about the wolverines in Wisconsin.
Yep.
And a friend of mine in Marinette, about 4 miles north of Wasaki on the east side of 41 there,
mm-hmm.
he emailed me a picture of one last year. And it was a real plain picture of a wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me he emailed it to the DNR, and they confirmed that it was a wolverine. So I just thought I'd share that.
Did he take it personally? He personally take the photo?
He took it on his photo cams. You know, he's an avid bow hunter, and he had photo cams out.
Oh.
And that's how he took the photo.
Oh.
You know, same response, I guess, as the first go-around. No documentation that I'm aware of truly wild animals. And of course, we went down this path years ago with cougars, too, Larry.
Right.
You see where that's taken us. But I just have relatively – it's a tough time seeing photographs of any kind now because you just don't know. The one that I wanted to alert people to, and I just heard about it again this morning. We have a fellow doing some work at the house, and he said, "Hey, did you see that picture on?" Or no, my bow hunting buddy sent me a picture of the guy with the 165-pound wolf from central Wisconsin somewhere. And, you know, that picture's been circulating now for almost a month, and that one was investigated, and the wolf was nowhere near 165 pounds. And as I think we even mentioned on the last program, I think Adrian's data from handling 500 or 600 wolves in the state, the biggest one they've ever handled, 108 pounds. So the point is that some of these pictures, especially when it's something unusually big, unusually rare, unusually something, they take on a life of their own, and they tend to generate some reports in terms of either location or size that are simply in question. So it makes it unfortunate because folks sending in really beautiful pictures to your Facebook page and all, you know, that legitimate stuff is sometimes overshadowed by stuff that you wonder, is this really true or not?
Yeah.
So
that's
just the way people are, I guess.
And
some people.
And this one, you know, if it was your friend who actually got the picture, it sounds like it was.
So then you have to wonder also, okay, where'd that wolverine come from? So,
was it a release or escapee? Yeah.
But you remember the white moose pictures and the giant cougar, all these things that are attributed to a place or a time that they weren't. So it makes it difficult. That's all.
Norm in Wausau, thank you for calling. Hello.
Good morning. I have two questions. One is about woodpeckers, and the other is about squirrels. On the woodpeckers, my wife and I like to put out suet sacks and sunflower seed for the songbirds. But what happens is we have a rough sawn cedar-sided house.
Uh-oh.
And the woodpeckers are just absolutely wrecking the siding.
Yes.
What are we encouraging them by putting that suet out? And secondly, if we are, we can stop, obviously. Is there anything we can do to stop the damage to the house?
Well, this is a very complicated question. Woodpecker damage to siding, it can be a very, very serious problem financially. I mean, in years gone by, or over the years, I should say, I've seen natural wood siding homes that have had to be virtually completely re-sided thanks to woodpeckers. So it can be very costly, and it's very frustrating and very annoying, to say the least. But I've had or dealt with folks with serious woodpecker damage who don't feed birds at all. So it can happen even if you're not feeding. On the other hand, if you've got a lot of suet cakes out, for example, I don't think I'd have any woodpeckers at my feeding stations if I didn't have the suet out. I've got vinyl siding, so the house damage isn't an issue, but I think if I stopped putting out the suet, the woodpeckers would go elsewhere. You can try that, but if they're tuned into the house, or if there are any insects in the siding, which is another possibility, or if they're tuned into hammering on the house for territorial behavior, meaning it peaks in the spring, then the feeding is somewhat irrelevant. In terms of actually stopping it, that is even trickier. In that case, you've got to go to sheets of bird netting. You can try various scare tactics. Those generally are not long-term and not very satisfactory. But mechanical protection like sheets of bird netting draped down over the siding, different type of siding. There are a variety of tactics, but I think if you, Norman, I guess I'd recommend that you maybe do a little internet work on woodpecker damage, and some of the things will be laid out in terms of what you can do. We actually have through University Extension, so you could also check your extension office, which I think is in Wausau, and see if you can get a copy of the Woodpeckers and Homeowners brochure. And that one also may be online now on the new extension website on wildlife damage. That'll kind of walk you through the steps to solve the problem.
Yep, and good luck.
And good luck. Now, what I'm...
The squirrel question.
Oh, yeah, the squirrels. Shoot.
We have four apple trees by our house, and we had some guests here this fall, and I was going to show them the beautiful apple crop we had, which I'd been watching carefully. And I walked back there, and to my amazement, three of the trees were almost completely stripped of all apples, and the one that still had some on had probably a third of what it originally had on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm no absolutely sure it was those gray squirrels, because subsequently I watched and I saw them taking up in the tree, taking it down, and I was reminded of this when somebody called on one of your programs and they said they had a mink up in the top of the tree shaking the limb where the apples were on, and they were sure it was a mink. I'm sure it was a squirrel. And people say that squirrels don't take apples, and I don't know if it was because of a failure of our acorn crop locally here, or it was because of the drought, and of course apples have 85 or 90% water in them. I don't know what it was, but they just absolutely devastated our fruit trees.
Well, I don't even know how to respond, because you both asked the question and answered it very well at the same time. I lost a few apples this year to squirrels as well. I don't have nearly as many squirrels as you do, because we're kind of out in the open. But I think a combination of poor food availability from other sources and the fact that, as you pointed out, apples are essentially a little bag of apple-flavored water, so to speak, that those were very attractive to a number of animals that otherwise wouldn't bother them. So you may go the next 10 or 20 years not lose many apples at all. If, on the other hand, your squirrels, the ones that survived the winter, have developed a taste for apples, then you're going to have to do a little squirrel removal from within the orchard or within the trees themselves come late next summer.
Yep, there you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, yep. Thanks a lot for calling, Norm. Fred in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Hi, guys. A few questions. I haven't heard much about chronic wasting disease, and I was wondering what the status of that is, if it's pretty well contained. Up until about a week ago here in Wisconsin Rapids, we had a wren going into our sunflower feeders, which was kind of unique, we've never seen before. And then third, I took a buck this fall, and it had its eye out, and it was moist underneath where the eye was, where it just happened. And when I registered it on the registration station or where I took it to be processed, never saw that. So my guess is that that happened during the rut.
Mm-hmm.
Got a tine in the eye. Have you ever heard of that happening?
Mm-hmm. Those tines, a buck that's been involved in some skirmishes during the rut may have holes just about anywhere, and I certainly think the way those antlers are flailing around, I'm surprised more of them aren't blinded. So that's the likely explanation, but chasing a doe, fleeing something else, and taking it's not common, but a stick in the eye, a tine in the eye from a fight, there are probably a variety of explanations, but I think the most likely one is the one that you you came up with. As far as the CWD situation, it's still out there, hasn't gone anywhere, still turning up in new places on the edge of the area that had been well-defined over the last few years. We'll see what the testing shows this year in terms of prevalence rates, but they've been ratcheting up over the years, especially in adult animals and especially in bucks. I'm pretty happy the two deer I registered. I got the yellow cards back yesterday that they were negative from testing, so that's good news for me personally, and everybody who has them tested hopes to get those yellow cards in the mail that say they're negative. But some people, unfortunately, still get a call from the local warden that says they need to should dispose of the deer. So it's still out there, but given everything else, given the time span that we've been dealing with it, and probably given what's on everybody else's mind between physical cliffs and a variety of other problems, CWD seems to have kind of fallen off the main radar screen for a lot of hunters. And as a result, in part because of that and in part because of the Deer Czar's report last summer, some changes have been made in CWD management in that Earn a Buck was modified to a more user-friendly bonus buck plan this year. The October antlerless season was ended. The extended landowner hunt that occurred during the late winter and spring was ended. So things have slowed down a little bit, but the bottom line is it's still out there. Probably still represents a threat of uncertain magnitude, but a lot of folks who were previously fairly agitated about it in terms of landowners and hunters have either been desensitized or are slowly learning to live with it. So I don't know what that means for the future, but it's certainly still out there.
Thanks, Fred, for calling. And Kay in Prairie du Chien, thank you. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I love listening to your program.
Thank you.
I know that the male and female wolf of the pack, the alpha male and the alpha female, are very important to the role of the structure of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
And their discipline and their life, well, they're staying alive and such. And now, what effect does the hunting have on the wolf pack if the male or the female or both are killed in the hunt? I'm not against wolf hunting,
right?
But for them to kill the alpha male or the alpha female, to me, sounds like it could really upset the pack structure and the wolf family structure and start maybe making the wolves kind of go maybe as a lone wolf or a...
Right. It certainly could disrupt their social structure, and they have a very well understood and very defined social structure. However,
they're disciplined too, though.
Yes, and a pack that's disrupted by the loss of the one of the lead pair may have some problems with adjoining packs, but the fact is, the alpha males or alpha females don't live forever. So sooner or later, every pack has to face a change in leadership. So it's not completely disastrous, but the fact of the matter, I think the proof will be in the pudding when the season is declared over here, probably very shortly. Then I think the information will be widely disseminated in terms of what the sex and age structure of the harvest was. And I think, and we talked about this a little before, I think Larry has heard the same thing, that the majority of the animals taken were young animals that played a minimal role in the cohesiveness of their social structure. So let's hold that thought for another month or so, maybe until the January program, when we see what was actually harvested. And I think what we'll see is that very few of those animals key to the social structure were actually harvested.
It was mostly
or killed.
Young.
It was mostly young ones, so.
I sure appreciate it, but that's been something that's kind of weighed on my mind even before, so.
Well, I think it's a good thought, and it's correct, but I think the way the hunt played out, there was probably much less disruption than people might have been concerned about. But we'll see. Let's see what happens, and we'll make a note to talk about it again in January.
Okay. Thank you so very, very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist, our guest today. Great to have him along. Certainly you can join in. We have one open line at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. I just wanted to remind, while I'm thinking about it, I'll be hosting our Garden Talk program on Friday, this Friday, from the Marcus Center for the Performing Arts in Milwaukee. So if you're in the Milwaukee area on Friday, I'll be there, and Melinda Myers is my guest. So Melinda, Mel Myers, and I will be there at the start of the show, obviously, from 11 to 12:30. And you could come get there early if you would like, and we'll have a chance to chat. I know I'm going to try and be there by 10 or so, and Melinda is going to be there, I'm sure, by probably around 10 as well. And we'll have a chance to visit with you. And it doesn't cost anything. Just show up at the Marcus Center for the Performing Arts in downtown Milwaukee. If you want more information on it, just go to our website at wpr.org/Milwaukee. wpr.org/Milwaukee. I'm Larry Mueller with Scott Craven here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have Scott Craven with us today. Scott, wildlife ecologist, and he comes by, usually it's the first Monday of the month, or Wednesday of the month, and next month it will be the first Wednesday, won't it, Scott? January?
I think so. Yeah. I don't know when that is, but it's...
Yeah, it'll be the first Wednesday of the month. We'll have that for you. We had a zookeeper at the Henry Vilas Zoo, Elizabeth. I'm going to try and see if I can get this up. She has a video up on Facebook, and I just lost it. Let's see here. It's a video of a red tail having a snack on a squirrel.
Uh-huh.
And she says, so if you want to see a video of that, the red tails have a squirrely snack. These city birds seem pretty used to guests and zookeepers alike, and we often get calls that one of our charges has escaped. But... Not really. That's just a wild one that, and I'm going to try and get that up.
We had two such incidents on campus that I can recall. One in the horticultural gardens, and one in front of the old vet science building where red tails on campus caught a gray squirrel.
So there's one, and I'm looking at the video right. We're looking at the video right now.
Not for the squeamish.
having a little lunch. That's very, very cool, Elizabeth. Thank you so much. By the way, the Vilas, I've been a member of the Vilas Park Zoo for a long, long time, and it's a great place to visit. You get to Madison, if you're in the Madison area, it's a free, one of the free zoos in the, probably in the country. There aren't that many of that quality that are free. So great to have her contact us. And Becky and Nakusa, it's your turn to talk. Hi.
My husband and I own 10 acres in central Wisconsin, and we were taking a walk through our woods last week, and we were walking along the trail, and we found a small gob of turkey feathers, and I looked at them, and I said, these look like they got pulled out. And so we walked a little farther down the trail, and we found another bigger gob of turkey feathers, and we said, these definitely got pulled out. And we probably walked another 30 yards down the trail, and we found what was left of the turkey.
Mm-hmm.
So what was left of the turkey was the wings,
mm-hmm.
a very few feathers, and the gizzard. And so it was all contained in an area that was like less than 4 feet square, and I wondered what kind of an animal ate its snack without dragging it around. I know we have a lot of coyotes in the area, and we've heard rumors about, you know, maybe a big cat. And I just wondered what you thought might have eaten that turkey.
Could have been so many things.
The list is very long, and of course, you know, not having more evidence, you don't know if for sure the turkey was killed by the animal or animals that ate it, or whether it was scavenged from a turkey that died for some other reason. escaped from a fall turkey hunt or hit, yeah. Who knows? Many reasons, many things that could have killed a turkey that was then scavenged, many things that could have killed the turkey. Coyotes and fox and things like larger animals are on the top of the list that could have taken it on the ground. Did it seem to be a big turkey? Because Pulse...
There was nothing left but the wings okay. and a few feathers.
Well, and this time of year, too, you know, late hatch, poults are not, the young turkeys called poults, mm-hmm. are not particularly large. And, you know, one could have been even knocked out of the roost by a great horned owl or whatever. In terms of picking it clean in a small area, that could have been the work of what killed it. But it could have also been the work of a number of scavengers, including a carcass. Any large carcass in the woods is visited by all sorts of things, from possums and even small right. mammals and songbirds and so forth. So I think a coyote, as you speculated, coyote or bigger animal probably would have distributed, carried some of it off, maybe even cached some of it. So it was picked clean like that. It could have... Go ahead.
I did look at what was left of the wings, and they looked like they had been gnawed on. So mm-hmm. it wasn't yeah. like a crow had cleaned it up or something. It had definitely been chewed on.
Yeah. And there again, you know, raccoons, possums, fox, coyote, any of the weasel family, even some small mammals, and it could have been a true team effort with lots of things taken care of cleaning it up. If you sit in the woods, you know, for whatever reason. Near a carcass or near a gut pile that some hunter left behind or whatever during the season, it's really amazing what will visit it and clean things up.
We were, just to give you a little story, I think I may have told this before, but we living on Lake Monona in Madison, my wife looked out, and just as an eagle swooped down in the middle of the lake, was on frozen, the lake was frozen, but there was a little open patch, and there were some Canada geese there. And the eagle nailed a Canada goose and chewed away on it for a while. And she got me there. And then later on, we looked out, and here are some crows. And there were crows chewing away on it. And maybe an hour or two later, here's a red fox that had gone all the way across the lake to over to that goose. And then there were some birds after that that were so... It was quite an experience, and I'll bet by the end of the day there was nothing left of that goose.
No, it doesn't take very long, Larry. Even something as large as a deer, when they were doing the carcass decomposition studies in relation to CWD, a deer carcass staked out in the woods in as short as a 10 days or 2 weeks, no trace, completely gone. So.
Yeah,
it happens. So lots of possibilities. I'm afraid we can't pin it down for you, but other than to say that some subset of Wisconsin's wildlife had a nice Thanksgiving dinner there in your woodlot.
All right. Well, I guess I'll have to make a little gut pile and sit out there and watch.
Well, there are other ways to do it. If you can, you don't have to sit there. You can get yourself a trail camera. And yeah. that's the way the deer composition studies were done, is if you find something road killed along the road, or you have a turkey carcass from dinner or whatever else, put it out and set your trail camera on it, and I think you'll find quite an interesting assemblage of pictures in terms of who visits.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot, Becky. Appreciate your call very much. We have, who's John in Appleton next? Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call,
sure.
Scott and Larry. I'm new to hunting and really grown passionate about ruffed grouse hunting. I do quite a bit of hunting up in the Lakewood area, northern Oconee County. But I want to be better at it by knowing where and how to find the ruffed grouse. Is there an internet resource that can help me find aspen packs or find the best habitat in public land that I can hunt the ruffed grouse on?
Holy cow, the possibilities are almost endless here, John. Let's see how to start. First of all, the Shawamig and Nicolet National Forests in the northern part of the state cover expansive forest areas, and there's been timber harvest on both over the years. Both of those forests put out cover maps which indicate where aspen harvests have been made in the year they were cut. And those are put out as a resource to hunters. For example, the Shawamigan or the Forest Service Office for the Shawamigan and Park Falls would have those maps right there, and they're probably available online as well. Some of the counties, for example, Lincoln County puts out the same kind of map for the county forest system, which indicates where there's alder cover, which would hold both woodcock and grouse, and also, again, where timber has been harvested, and therefore that usually means aspen up there. So there are very good mapping resources available as to what's out there on the landscape from both the counties and the state and federal government. So the state forest, the American Legion Northern Highland, would also have similar resources. Price County puts out, in fact, I think most of the counties have like a visitor's guide type map to the county. And in the case of the Price County map, it lists all of the industrial forest land, county forest land, state and federal forest land in different colors on the map by section. And then there's also a side piece that indicates all of the hunter access walking trails that are actually maintained by the various levels of government for hunters to walk along on through these different types of public forest ownership. Plus, Park Falls calls itself, rightfully so, the rough grouse capital of the world, so there's all sorts of resources available in Park Falls. You probably learn a lot of good stuff by going to the website of the Ruffed Grouse Society, which has lots of publications on grouse ecology and management. Those are just a few things that come to mind, but you couldn't, if you hunted every day for the rest of your life, you couldn't exhaust the places those resources could steer you to.
Okay, so just maybe stopping at one of the forest services up there.
Yep.
We pass a few in our drive up would be a good first step.
Stop at a Forest Service office or give them a call. I suspect they could mail things out or check their websites or stop at the DNR, any of the DNR offices in the American Legion Northern Highland, and you'll be off and running.
And the last question I have is, as it's the snow starting to fall and the cover is different, mm-hmm. where can I expect to find those rough grouse now? I know they kind of change as the winter rolls in.
Well, they tend to move. There's not much cover for them in kind of the classic open aspen stands, so I'd be looking more toward the conifers and the lowland swamps, and especially since it's been so darn dry in some areas, somewhere near water.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever food resources you can find, and realizing that as the snow gets really deep, one of the coolest things about grouse is, of course, that they roost under the snow. And several times, if you've never experienced it, as you're walking along,
it
doesn't matter whether you're hunting or just walking in the woods or snowshoeing or whatever else, if you stumble across a grouse in a snow roost and that bird explodes out of the powder snow, it's just
it gets
like
your attention.
It definitely sends a chill down your spine. So it's a pretty cool thing. So it's a neat time of year to be out looking for them again, whether you're hunting or not.
And thanks, John, for calling. I appreciate it. Going back to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, we've had so many. We've got video of a red tail eating a squirrel. We've got here a photo that LC wants us to try and identify this bird. It's a little bigger than the finch, a typical finch, but I've never seen the orange color before.
Well, it looks like a pine grosbeak to me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think that would be the I need to go over and look at the screen from about an inch with my current eyesight, but it looks like bigger than a finch, but shaped like a finch. The big bill, the coloration on the rump and on the head. I think it's a pine grosbeak, but it does seem a little inordinately orangey rather than what I would have expected. But just start with your field guide there, whoever sent the picture in, and see what you come up with.
And if
other people looking at the Facebook page have an alternative explanation, give us a call.
Yeah, give us a
call. It wouldn't be the first time we've been wrong, would it?
No, it would not. You can post on our Facebook page, too. And by the way, speaking of pine grosbeaks, Gary in Rhinelander emailed us. Fairly large numbers of them have been in the Rhinelander area for a good couple of weeks, as well as the red poles and the siskins. This is the earliest that he's seen all these species in the winter for a long time. Grosbeaks are in especially large numbers just west of Rhinelander.
There you go.
So that's pretty cool. And We have some more other bird photos up as well that I want to try and get back to here. Fooling around here with our Facebook page.
Looks like we've got some good answers coming up to our woodpecker problem, too.
Scott Craven will be with us right up until 12:30 today, so I want to make sure you stick around. We got lots of good calls coming up and some more Facebook photos to look at. You stay with us. We'll be back right after this look at the news here on the Ideas Network. The diversity and richness of our Wisconsin wildlife, great, isn't it? It's one of the many things that make our state such a special place to live and frankly, bring visitors from all over the world. And while it may be warm weather activities that bring people to our state, most of the time, lots of great ways to get outdoors, even in winter. Larry Mueller here. So glad to have you join us on the Ideas Network when we visit with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. He's our guide to the outdoors. He has some great ideas for ways to enjoy the outdoors and to be good stewards of nature. You may have a question about your wildlife. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can also visit my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show and go there. Click like while you're there. If you click like, we will send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be back with Scott Craven right after this look at the news. Seems like we're never at a loss for topics to cover about our wonderful Wisconsin wildlife. Scott Craven, great person to point things out and explain what we might be seeing. He's a wildlife ecologist, comes by once a month, usually the first Wednesday of the month. Frankly, next month in January, he'll be here on the second, which is the first Wednesday of the month. Scott, as always, thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Well, I wouldn't miss it if I could. I mean, I can't.
Well, we have, you know, we've got some great stories. If you look back to 2012, there were some wonderful wildlife stories. And I was looking online, the latest DNR magazine? I can't remember which. But they had the top 10 stories from 2012.
Yes, as judged, I think, by the agency folks who are involved with this kind of thing, they assembled their top 10, and there's some pretty cool ones on here. Do I have a minute to run through a couple of them?
Yeah,
Let's do it. Number one, the snowy owl invasion or eruption last winter. I mean, as you recall, we were fielding all kinds of questions about snowy owls. And just reported on the Wisconsin eBirds online database, there were over 700 sightings of 200-plus owls. And it was a major eruption last year, but it appears there's going to be another one, perhaps a little dampened this year. But there have already been several dozen snowy owls reported in Wisconsin this winter, mostly up along the shores of Lake Superior in Michigan. So keep your eye out for those snowy owls. The bat folks, in their searches, kind of a double-sided good story. Number one, as the bat folks with the agency were searching caves and mines, about 100 of them throughout the state looking for white nose syndrome, good news is they didn't find any.
That's great.
That's really good news. And the spinoff was they found an albino little brown bat, which is viewed as kind of a one-in-a-million shot, and they have a very nice picture of it posted on the webpage. So the albino bat. For the folks interested in sturgeon, last year, state crews netted a 240-pound, 7-foot, 3-inch sturgeon on April 10th in the Wolf River, and that big fish is still out there swimming around. And that eclipses by a fair bit the largest fish speared during recent years, which was 212 pounds in 2010. So that monster's out there, and it's probably a little bigger now. That's a big fish.
Oh, man, that is a
the size
big
of a canoe. Well, anyway, in addition to the invasion of snowy owls, there were many, many dick thistles. It kind of looks like a sparrow-like meadowlark. It's a prairie bird, but there were many, many dick thistles around last year. That was kind of an interesting thing on the bird front. Number five was the very early arrival of all of our birds last spring because of that bizarre March weather, which seems like a distant memory, but boy, it led to an incredibly warm and dry summer, and that's caused all of its own problems for wildlife. Let's see, a record number of young swans, 373 last year for the Trumpeter Swan Recovery Program. That was another record, and lots of folks excited about that. Three new dragonfly species documented for Wisconsin. That's kind of cool. And then I think number 10 is worthy of some mention. This kind of thing usually makes the national news. An eagle diving to feed on a muskrat carcass on Highway 10 near Fremont got embedded in the grill of a truck that was going by.
I saw the photo of that.
So the eagle was embedded in the shattered grill, and they called the sheriff's office for help. In turn, a conservation warden showed up to free the bird, and with the help of all concerned, they got it to a New London bird rehabilitator. And after a month in the rehabber's care, the bird recovered and was released back into the wild. So that was one lucky eagle, and it was fortunate a lot of people who knew what they were doing were on hand to help out. So that's some kind of feel-good stories for the year. So
and
a good thing as we enter the end of the year and the holiday season.
And it's also, those are up online, so you can see photos.
You can see photos of the incidents and read the entire story, and it's kind of a cool thing to do. I think if you go to the DNR website and search.
Judith's actually putting it up on our Facebook page.
Okay. I think it's a matter of searching top 10 or something like that on the website, and you can find them all.
Yeah, if you go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, you'll be able to take a look at all those, because you didn't cover them all.
No, there's a couple others, too. Well, leave something for the folks to turn up on their own.
Well, I tell you what, we're coming up in 15 seconds. It's going to be 12 minutes after 12.
Wow.
So it's 12 minutes after 12 on the 12th day of the 12th month of 2012. So if you were going to post something right now, right this second, right this minute, You would say, I'm posting this at 12, 12, 12, 12, 12.
12.
5, 12. And we can only do it for another 45 seconds, Scott. So
that is pretty cool. And it just happens to be one of our grandson's birthdays today. So he's pretty excited about 12, 12, 12, too.
Oh, that's cool. Well, Bob and Krivitz, I don't know if you're excited about 12, 12, 12, but you have a question or comment?
I have a comment. Okay, a gentleman called in earlier about the moles that were drowning in his pail, and then Scott had mentioned cutting 5-gallon or 5-quart pails.
Yep.
Okay, I had the same problem when I built my cabin. I'm on the backside of Governor Thompson State Park, and I did work for the DNR part-time for about 5 years. Okay, and I feed everything from chipmunks to bears in my yard. And I had an incident when I first built the cabin. My granddaughter was about 3, and I brought her up, and we usually feed all the animals and the birds in the water. And there was a dead chipmunk floating in the pail, and boy, it just tore her up. So I put built a square box around the 5-gallon pail out of deck boards,
yep.
So to have a little bit more stability. I took a 2x2 and cut a notch in the top of it, and I lay it on an angle from the top of the 5-gallon bucket all the way to the bottom. And I cut a slot net about every half inch apart. And since that time, I've got everything from chipmunks to moles to bears and deer and birds crawling up and down it. And everybody drinks just fine. And during the drought season like this, I go through about 7 gallons of water a day.
Cool. Very cool.
Good idea. So you actually turned a potential death trap into a watering station for wildlife. So
you bet. I've got two of them in the front yard, one in the backyard.
Good. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Okay, have a good one.
Yeah, you too.
We
That's
solved
a
that.
Great story.
You solved the problem if you've got a water garden, which is another popular feature for folks, and it's a little deep for a wildlife to drink. I just took a log and set it into the pond on an angle. And you can actually grow some moss on it or something. But the birds have learned. They just land on the log and walk right down to the edge of the water, get a drink, and then walk back out.
Frankly, the log kind of looks nice.
And it's another feature in the water garden. Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Larry, if you could just take a second. This came up. It was an email request from a listener that Judith brought in. Someone had requested a little more information on wildlife sounds that we talked about last month.
Yes.
Specifically, let's see, it was Rachel had emailed in and was looking for a CD with a coyote call on it. Mammal calls and sounds are a lot more difficult to find than bird calls and songs, which are relatively easy. But I think that the since it's specifically a coyote, don't check necessarily the natural sounds. With coyotes, you can look in the sporting industry, and some of the bigger outfitters like Gander Mountain or Cabela's or whatever.
Dick's or whatever.
Or maybe. Particularly go to a game call outfit called Johnny Stewart's Game Calls. And because coyotes are hunted and often calls are used to attract them, I think you can find lots of stuff on coyote vocalizations through the game call industry. So that would be worth checking out for Rachel.
And while we're at it, what about gifts? Man, there's so many.
For the holiday season? Funny you should ask.
Man, there's a bunch.
Well, you're right. There is a just an incredible array of things available. Electronics, GPS units, rangefinders. I finally joined the rest of humanity and got a smartphone not too long ago. And, you know, the things you can do with a smartphone in terms of navigation or having a camera always at your fingertips to grab a picture of something you otherwise would miss, those are good ideas. The array of clothing in terms of camouflage, waterproof, footwear, scent blocker, just stuff for people who like to be outdoors and see wildlife, not just necessarily for hunters or consumptive users. The gadgetry that's available, the little burrs-off tool, which looks like a piece of pumice stone, but it takes the burrs and stick tights right off your clothes. It's tons of stuff. If you spend time in one of the bigger outlets or spend a little time on the websites for the big outfitters, you find a ton of stuff. I think a pretty neat gift for somebody is membership in any one of the dozens of NGOs or non-governmental organizations we talk about that do good conservation work. Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, Rough Grouse Society, Rocky Mountain Elk, Whitetails Unlimited. There are dozens
of them. Every one of those is great.
Every one of them is great. And with membership, you usually get a magazine or a newspaper. You can go to the banquet. A neat thing for somebody interested in the outdoors. And although it may seem a little strange, I would suggest for someone who maybe has stopped hunting or even someone who's a non-hunter, a duck stamp or even a hunting license is a tremendous boon to wildlife funding. And it's not just a matter of funding the self-interest of hunting groups. The money is used for many different things. And a duck stamp, for example, goes strictly to habitat conservation and benefits so many types of birds and wetland animals. Interesting little gift. And, of course, there's wildlife art, subscriptions to the DNR magazine, which covers all aspects of natural resources in Wisconsin, or the Outdoor News newspaper, which is where I keep track of a lot of stuff that's going on.
A lot of Wisconsin Outdoor News is great.
So there's a ton of things out there, but I think the notion of the duck stamp or the NGO memberships, it may be a little kind of outside the box, but I think recipients would be most appreciative.
Just recently, I had the author of a book about the artists and the federal who draw and compete for the federal duck stamp. And in that book, it talks about the millions of acres and the thousands of species that are benefited. And it's always been a problem to get non-hunters to buy, even though, I mean, this is the most important. It's probably the most important single thing for the preservation of wildlife that has ever happened in this country.
Well, it's certainly near the top of the list. One of the unfortunate thing when we talk about wildlife is that many of our species have been pigeonholed into, well, it's a game bird or a game animal or it's a non-game animal.
Right.
The reality of the situation is that our so-called game animals, I think you can make a good case that they're also our most important non-game animals.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about Canada geese, sure, they're a game bird, but think about the tens of thousands of people who drive around Horican Marsh in the fall just to see them or take pictures of them or enjoy seeing them. They're only a game animal during that very narrow window in the fall when they're hunted. The rest of the year, they're a non-game animal. And I think that particular division of wildlife across the country has been counterproductive over the years. But anyway.
Buy a federal duck stamp. And just go to the post office. Yep. And actually now you can go to Gander Mountain, I believe, sells them.
Other outlets.
And other outlets too. As well.
I think they're still $15, but it's a good way to benefit wildlife. And then, of course, when we come back in January, we'll talk about the Endangered Resources Fund, which is another way to get some of your conservation dollars into the system.
Yep, absolutely. Dick in Rice Lake has a comment for us. Hi, Dick.
Good afternoon. It's been a long wait, but well worth it. woodpeckers.
Yeah.
We've had a problem in about 15 years or so. I listened to your program and was told to put some mirrors up, among other things. And we did it with reasonable success. But what has worked the best, I buy two inexpensive round mirrors, about an inch and a half in diameter, glue them back to back, put a swivel between them with a little bit of monofilament line, hang it from the soffit, and it constantly rotates, even with the slightest amount of wind.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last year, we have not had a problem, and that's the first time in 22 years.
Huh.
So do you think it's the fact that this mirror is, you know, catching light and these little spots of light, like a disco ball, are flashing on the wall, or do you think they're seeing something in the mirror?
No idea. Why? I think I was told, or I understood I was told before, probably from you, that, you know, if they see the reflection or just the movement would keep them away.
Hmm. Could be just...
Whatever it is, it works. And I put a couple up, our entryway, 5 feet apart, different heights, and they're just constantly in rotation.
Huh.
And we have not had a problem with woodpeckers since then. I'll knock on wood because you never want to say never. But it works. In fact, when I bought some mirrors up at a little discount store, I told her what it was for, and she says, my gosh, you ought to get a patent on that. it works. And the other thing is we have a grandson who's 12 on 12, 12, 12. How about that?
That's pretty cool.
That's great.
Anyway, that's my contribution. I love your program.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call.
Thanks.
We have here's a caption of a photo that a listener, Paul, sent us from Mosinee Times. The trail camera photograph of a mountain lion was taken by Bud S. of his property just east of Stratford. Early in the morning of November 29th, experts believe the radio collar was probably placed on the cat in the Black Hills of South Dakota.
Hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Good photograph.
Yeah, nice photograph. So thanks for that. Gene in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Fabulous program. I have two comments. Oh, and there's a good picture of a badger in yesterday's Post Crescent, too. I'm sorry, I don't know where it was, a trail cam picture.
Ah.
I don't know where it was, but I'm assuming it was associated with someone local. I have a question about the CWD and donated deer to food, you know, whether they be meals or whether they be food that can be picked up.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a danger to people? Because I'm very concerned that all along people have not had all of the deer that they harvested tested.
Okay.
Well, there are a couple of things. The deer that are run into the system and formally donated into the programs like Hunters for Hungry and so forth are usually held. When the deer are registered, they're given a barcode, and the deer, to my understanding, are held in storage, in cold storage, frozen, until the test results are back. And then the deer that test negative, which is the vast majority of them, are then put into the stream so that they can actually provide the protein source that they're destined to become. And any that are tested positive are disposed of. So I think you're okay in that regard, but you're also correct in that there are lots of deer harvested within the area described as the CWD management zone that are not tested. So there's sort of a leap of faith there, but the fail-safe is that there's still not a shred of evidence that there's any true risk to humans from consuming. They recommend you don't if you know it's positive, but there's no evidence that the disease is transmissible to humans.
Mm-hmm.
So
there you go. Thank you very much for calling, Gene. Oh, by the way, Steve emailed us, and he wanted to add As a gift, a beautiful and very informative magazine from Quality Deer Management Association. Mm-hmm. Magazine's called Quality Whitetail. So that's another
photography is fantastic, and that's another case where if you join the Quality Deer Management Association, which is yet another of these groups we were talking about, that's the magazine that you get. And it's if you're really into deer, it's just packed with stuff related to deer and deer management.
And Eric emailed, last weekend after butchering his doe, I laid out the carcass in front of my trail cam. Couldn't wait to check it out. Within 10 minutes of putting out the carcass, the crows were squawking and hovering right over it.
Mm-hmm.
How in the heck did they locate it so fast? Is there a sense of, is it the smell or the eyesight with crows? It wouldn't be smell.
No, it's. I mean, there are enough crows. Crows are very social and communicative. And if a crow finds a great horned owl, it doesn't take but a few seconds before every crow in the area knows there's an owl to be mobbed, and it's the same thing with a big food source like that. So,
and a photo online again from, let's see, I'm not sure who that's from. Oh, from Kim.
That nice female cardinal?
Actually, is it a cardinal or is it? Yeah, it could be. Probably is a female cardinal. Female cardinal, this is a
nice photo.
Yeah, absolutely. Ron in Newburgh will turn to you. Hi, Ron.
Hello, good afternoon. I've got a hole that showed up in the backyard, 9 inches in diameter, 16 inches deep, and it seems to have a little tunnel going off to the side where dirt was maybe kicked back a little bit to act as a doorway. Any thought of who it might be?
9 by 16, you said.
Yeah. Well, I put some raspberry canes over the hole now to see if he comes out, and nobody has come out of it.
Well, the way you describe it, it almost seems as though if there's a smaller diameter hole going off to the side, then it sounds to me like a larger animal, fox, badger, or whatever, capable of digging the hole, trying to dig up the pocket gopher, ground squirrel, or whatever it was that was living underground in that small side hole.
Okay.
That
sounds like what was going on there, but again, you never know for sure. If besides the raspberry canes, if there's loose soil around, of course it's tough now with snow and things are wet, but if things dry out, rake that soil out a little bit so you can see the track of whatever might come back too,
yeah,
and that'll
that,
also...
That I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, see what comes back. Maybe we'll get more information. But I'm guessing it was something trying to dig up a smaller mammal that what they knew was down there.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephanie in Woodford, you have a quick question?
Yes. About a week ago, underneath my aunt's old apple tree, I found this dead red-bellied woodpecker just lying there. And my cousin said, oh, that's been there since Thanksgiving, so like 10 days. And I picked it up. There wasn't a mark on it, no feathers disturbed, no blood, anything. Just kind of lying there as if it were asleep. So,
what could have happened, Scott?
good question, Larry. I find birds in the yard that are a result of window strikes. I've got a kind of a welded wire fence around the garden. I've had birds hit that and find them unmarked, just lying there. It could be anything, including a variety of different diseases that may have just taken it out. Don't know.
Scott, we'll look forward to your visit in 2013 on January 2nd.
Yes, right after the Badgers are victorious in the Rose Bowl. And in the meantime, happy holidays to everybody.
Happy holidays. Scott Craven, Emeritus Professor of Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison, our guest. And thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.